Hi, Misha. How's it going?
Great, Michael. Great to see you again.
Yeah, thanks for coming on the show. So what do you make of this latest coronavirus variant?
I think it's interesting for a few reasons. I mean, we're recording now on the 29th, so we've probably had a weekend of kind of news and havoc. I've got a personal interest in this. I've got a family trip booked to South Africa and Namibia for a big family safari holiday, which has kind of blown up, it looks like. So I'm quite vested. I think all the information to date, there's been like an enormous amount of noise to signal. Like, I think everything I read, people, you know, they're talking about specifications which don't matter, like deletions and mutations that no one really cares about. And no one can answer the basic questions of how dangerous is it and the like. Mm-hmm. And to be fair, you know, no one really knows, but I think people are making a pretty big deal about it. I think it's probably like if there's enough smoke, like around, you know, its rate of contagion or something, I think it's kind of fair enough to kind of go pretty harsh as early as you can until, you know, if this is like a super bug, some kind of super dangerous thing, who knows? I don't have a good sense for, you know, I don't have a good prize for my expectation for it to be more or less dangerous. So I think that's kind of fair. I think it's interesting, though, that you know, no one's talking about the things that matter. And all the symptoms so far seem to be pretty mild. And, you know, everyone who's vaccinated seems to be kind of okay. So I do wonder if it's a storm in a teacup at this time, albeit it's okay to kind of react hard early. Like, I like Israel just shutting its borders. Like, it's just done as a fair response. I think the test will be over the next few weeks how quickly governments can turn the ship and kind of be sensible about it, which I'd be interested. Hopefully very quickly, so I can go on my trip to South Africa. But I can't doubt that. What do you think?
I did notice the cases they had here were all asymptomatic. So just one of those ones where you don't even know you have it in most cases. Yeah. And it's interesting how it's kind of taken the usual path that you'd expect, which is more contagious, less dangerous with time. That's like the traditional trajectory of a virus. Yeah. Now, there's no guarantees. Things can mutate in more harmful ways, and there's definitely historical examples. But the vast majority is, you know, the more people a virus goes through, the more it adapts to people, the better it gets at spreading, and also the less harmful it gets. You know, it doesn't do anybody any, it doesn't do a virus any evolutionary good if it has you coughing and spluttering away. Or in the worst case, you know, passing out and not being able to infect lots of people. So far, it seems all in line with what you'd expect it to happen. And I do agree, I mean, everyone's just taking these like long list of mutations and trying to make a storm in a teacup. There's just so many people that are heavily invested in your lockdowns and making sure that all the political decisions and editorial decisions of the last 2 years are justified. It's very hard for people to kind of step away from that.
I think that's right. I think when you have you know, low evidence and low information, you have a lot of signal, what you do see is the kind of course of vested interests. And so you do see everyone who's kind of made a voice for themselves, you know, trying to maintain relevance and maintain importance. Obviously, you know, newspapers are kind of in the business of that as well. And you're right, you kind of have people with, you know, in certain battle formations, you know, ideological battle formations, trying to figure out how to kind of, map it onto the existing biases. So I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah, it's a tough one. I think last week was a pretty shaky one for market. But the first, most of the sell-off was kind of before the variant hit the headlines. It seemed to be more to do with rising rates, the rising inflation, and also the end or slowing down the tapering of quantitative easing. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I don't have strong views on like particular, last week's. I've got views on the broader macro. Like I'm not a native public markets guy. And I think often narratives kind of fit the event. So you'll have a crash and then, you know, everyone will say it's XYZ and no one really knows if it's XYZ. So I'm always a little bit skeptical of those things. I think, you know, inflation's obviously a big issue. And again, I don't think anyone really knows what's going on. I think if you ask 10 macroeconomists, they'll give you 10 answers about what that means. And so I kind of suspect in 50 or 100 years, if you look back at this period, there'll be a certain narrative around, you know, description of the ideology in which macroeconomists kind of thought during this period and how that was kind of wrong for whatever reason, as every previous, you know, period was kind of wrong or kind of follows certain fashion. So, and that includes me, like, as in I'm very skeptical of having my own kind of deep views on this. I think, though, obviously, you know, we've seen a very long multi-decade, certainly, and maybe multi-century decline in interest rates. And that's kind of the punchline here. So if we are seeing rising rates, and you're seeing some rising rates in kind of the peripheral economies like Australia and the UK, et cetera, and so potentially, you know, in the US, that obviously has pretty meaningful implications for asset valuations. And so, you know, how does something trade at 60 times revenue? You know, that kind of valuation you'd expect is possible, not just on the back of its growth, but because future cash flows are basically discounted at a very, very low interest rate implicitly. And so if that kind of increases, you obviously see present valuations decline. I think kind of top, very, very, very toppy valuations and kind of persistent cash flows, you know, potentially become discounted at higher high interest rates over time. Whether we are seeing, like, what the story around inflation is, you know, there's obviously the whole crypto narrative that, you know, the US dollar is being devalued and this is the end of empire. And I mean, I don't think it's like false necessarily. It's kind of hard to, I find it personally hard to kind of go all in on that kind of story. And then, you know, I think in terms of the broader inflationary story, I think everyone's been crying wolf about inflation for like at least a decade, probably longer for people with longer corporate memories. And so it's always hard to know who's right or wrong based on who happened to be, you know, still crying wolf, you know, over the last year. What do you think?
It basically got to the point where the last people that were crying wolf were out. Our favorite macro trade was to bet on rising rates, and it just didn't work for decades. And there were multiple funds that had to wind up because when markets were rallying, and they were losing money because they had this incorrect trade on. And then it seems like coronavirus, it kind of had a last hurrah in 2018. Rates started rising and then obviously ended up falling and just started to be rising again. And then coronavirus came and then wiped all those traders out. So there seemed to be nobody left of the old school macro rates are rising inflation crowd. Until of course it happened and you get these 6-7% inflation prints. But that's a story, you know, as old as markets. You know, they'll go in one direction until the last person throws in the towel.
My favorite, there's this great chart that kind of follows, you know, forward interest rate predictions, and you kind of get this furry looking chart with all these upward curves, and the actual rates have kind of continued to decline over time. My personal story is that I was working with a fund administration business, like at the start of my career, you know, around 10 years ago or so. And it's highly leveraged effectively. It's got a float, and so it's highly leveraged, its income's highly leveraged to interest rates. And every banker in the city and every forecast, like, it's gonna go up, it's absolutely fine. And this business has just kind of trundled along. It's been hard, obviously, you know, for the last decade, because that's obviously just been wrong. So I think, you know, I think narratives are always backfitted and like nobody knows.
Yeah, really difficult. Actually, I came across a really interesting company the other day. It's called Silvergate. Basically, it's a crypto company. It's very leveraged to higher interest rates. So what they do is they've got some of the major exchanges and major stable coins to sign up to them, basically, to manage the US dollar cash. And so this is like USDC, all these stable coins that are supposed to be backed dollar for dollar. And these ones are actually backed dollar for dollar. They need to transfer US dollars between themselves and they don't want to use payment rails. So they all store it with this one random company in the US. And basically they do it all for free. It's like a spreadsheet, you know, they just say the US dollars no longer belongs to this person, they belong to that person. And they've all had to sign up, they've done a deal on each customer. It's like very hard to get in, but once you're in, very super easy to transfer large amounts of USD in between each other. And they don't charge anything for that, but they've got these tens of billions of dollars USD sitting there. So every 1% interest rate, you know, makes real money for them. But I thought it was pretty ironic that at the heart of these USD stable coins and basically the largest crypto fiat exchanges, you had this one company that had created this payment network. Nothing to do with crypto at all.
But that's super interesting. I mean, crypto is like a bundle of, you know, potential solutions versus kind of current ideas and capabilities. You know, one, you know, clear use case for you know, crypto is it effectively automates a whole bunch of the financial system and kind of cuts out intermediaries. And so you know, here you're kind of creating intermediaries. So it's kind of, it's a bit of a paradox, but you know, why shouldn't you have, like, if you look at the current administration companies that basically do that, you know, they're enormously bloated. They send out letters. You know, they've got these old systems from like 20 years ago, and you've got this implied overhead. And if you can essentially have a trusted ledger and kind of, you know, automate that through, you know, algorithms, you know, basically, and call that crypto, you know, if you want, you know, why shouldn't that all be automated? And if their cream is the interest rates, that kind of makes sense, and that's kind of neat. So you kind of see this deflationary effect really in financial services. So to be honest, that kind of totally makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, it's still unbelievably difficult to move money around and do that kind of thing. I mean, we do it all the time. I mean, the settlements for trading, dealing with investor cash, investor flows, the fact that it can be instant or just take a few days, you don't know. There's no easy way to look it up. It's amazing how far there is to go. But are you a believer in Web3 and all the excitement around that?
I mean, at its heart, I'm a huge believer. Like, I don't feel native to it. Like, I'm not some, you know, developer who's hacking away at night, and I haven't been invested since like 2012 or something. So I'm part of this kind of, you know, new wave of interested you know, lay people really in finance. And I think believing in it and believing you know, that it's going to be big is totally compatible with thinking there's a whole bunch of bullshit and there's like Ponzi's everywhere you kind of look, which is kind of fun, to be honest, to kind of be in this strange universe. And so one thing on the Ponzi issue, you know, I found it interesting to think about. I've got very far thinking about it, but, you know, clearly some of these, you know, a lot of crypto products and platforms have a Ponzi aspect to them where they're kind of relying on growth and new entrants effectively to kind of bootstrap it up. But I wonder if at some point, the question is, you know, at what point does it either cease to be a Ponzi and it's kind of either, you know, becomes something else, you know, however you want to kind of frame a legitimate business or enterprise or platform, or, you know, can it be a Ponzi forever without the crash? And I think, you know, you could do a nice anatomy of Ponzi's, which I haven't done. And I know Ben Hobart wrote a recent newsletter kind of touching on this, but you know, the like Australian housing in some respects is a Ponzi, but, you know, it may well kind of persist forever. Or
I mean, like, a Ponzi to me Ponzi is very specific. It's a very specific kind of fraud. But pretty much every financial asset is bought with the ability and like to potentially sell it at a later date. So I think there's some element of confusion where people think, oh, just because you're buying something and you're relying on the fact you can sell it to somewhere else, that is a Ponzi. And then you're able to use that, all those awful fraudulent connotations of Ponzi, and put that label on any asset that people are buying just because they think they'll be able to sell it at a later date. But, you know, that's like the whole difference between, that's like what liquidity is all about. You know, that's why you have like private equity funds. They're completely different species to, you know, public listed market funds. So I don't know, they're just my initial thoughts on the Ponzi. I feel like it's a very overused word and it's like a very specific type of fraud, but I don't think it necessarily applies to every asset that people buy with the hope or expectation at some point they'll be able to sell it on to somebody else.
I think that's true, but I think, you know, I mean, when I refer to Australian housing, for example, you are kind of relying on, you know, the growth of new money and new entrants to kind of go in to sustain prices in the way you have, and given where leverage is as well in the system, that kind of feels like a, you know, I mean, maybe you're stretching the Ponzi label a little bit, but kind of feels apt. Someone's trying to sell me on, you know, this new, I won't name it, but it's kind of new currency and this new token, really. And it literally, you know, I kind of stripped away all the jargon around, and I said, is this how the economics work? And he said, well, no, if it worked like that, that would be a Ponzi. But actually, it's because it's being attached to this new rail system, and it's going to increase demand for this token. I'm saying, well, why would it increase demand for the token? Well, it's got an extremely high APY, like a yield effectively of over 1,000 in that token. And so it becomes like highly self-referential. And I don't think these guys are frauds or crooks or anything. And like, it may work in the end, but it does strike me that there are, it did just look like a classic Ponzi, to be honest. But then at some point, if it becomes a big enough part of the market, maybe it'll buy itself time to become something else.
Yeah, there is an element of that. So I feel like Tether's like that. So we're always getting certain things about Tether, and they've clearly done all kinds of trickery and almost certainly fraud. And they got slapped on the wrist by New York regulators. They said totally run they hold US dollars. They're now admitting they don't hold US dollars. Like, that means every statement has been false. But now it's like this huge enterprise. So it would have started so spivvy and fraudulent, got to some crazy $70, $80 billion scale, maybe more, maybe less, but certainly of that magnitude. And I can just see the founders like scrambling to legitimize themselves as fast as they possibly can.
It's a great example of that. So, and you kind of see that everywhere, but I don't know, I just find it interesting that I think, I'm very bullish Web3. I think in the same way that, you could be very excited by the internet in the 90s, and a lot of people were probably still underrating it. I think people are still, like, my fundamental view on it is that 10 years ago and 20 years ago, people were fundamentally underrating the importance of the internet and our digital lives, and how everything or many things would be meaningfully touched by that. And I think this is just an extension of that. This is just kind of native digital currencies, native digital networks, and the like. And so I think we probably still underestimate the impact of the internet. And I think this is just a natural evolution for it to go, rather than Facebook and Google kind of controlling the user experience and all the compute within their walled gardens. You have distributed compute across the world, and I think that's enormously exciting.
Yeah, I just can't believe how much value those kind of middle people kind of accrued. And to me, I've said it before on this podcast, Spotify is just such a good example. We don't necessarily care about Spotify. We want to listen to music from artists. And Spotify pays them nothing, but they've created $50 billion of equity market value, which is a serious amount of money. Like, they could go very far. I could fund a lot of musicians, with $50 billion. It's being captured by a small number of venture capitalists, early investors, founders, and there's this $50 billion gap between what the listeners are willing to pay effectively and what the creators get. It just seems like it's possible to reorder all those things. And the fact that crypto is so good for speculation makes it really good for crowdfunding, for new business models, for new governance models, for things like that. You can do a lot of, even if it just stays like a speculative asset class, but is used to fund new ways of doing things that kind of capture those tens and actually hundreds. Actually, if you include things like Instagram and Facebook, where everybody posts content for free, you're talking about trillions of dollars of value that is captured by a very small group of companies, which could potentially be shared amongst the people posting and the people consuming content.
I mean, some people criticize crypto for not having like real world use cases and kind of just bootstrapping a parallel financial, like $1 trillion parallel financial system with like no use case. But I think starting with bootstrapping $1 trillion financial system is like a pretty good place to start.
Not trivial. And, what was the company I was looking at recently? DLocal. So we don't own it, but it's like growing super fast. It helps people do international payments. Somewhere like, the Philippines or South America, it's very hard to actually get Spotify. You have to go and buy Spotify payment cards in a supermarket. Because,
I didn't know that.
Because they can't, they'll only accept US American credit cards. They won't do it from around a country, and they've created this huge business over that. And it's unbelievable today. And this is not something that's like, this is the disruptor. This is the company that's coming in and making it all digital. And it's literally that bad. Haven't quite got to the bottom of it. Still need a bit of work on that company. And don't feel any enormous pressure with respect to time, because it's one of these extremely rich companies. I mean, the multiples halved, but it's still on an absolute basis extremely expensive. People in many countries in the world have to jump through extraordinary numbers of hoops just to access Spotify, just to pay YouTube. Amazon uses them. Even companies like that, still have huge payment issues all around the world.
On your creator point, I think it was Chris Dixon who said, you know, the internet's not bad for creators. Kind of Web 2, you know, this era of the internet has been terrible for creators. But Web 3 and, you know, the internet could be amazing for creators. You know, to your point, you know, if you can kind of disintermediate Spotify and go direct to your artist. I mean, people, like, music has got to be one of the biggest areas of fan love. You know, I would love to have a more direct relationship with the musicians and the artists whom I love, rather than, as you say, being ferried through Spotify or whomever and kind of allowing them to capture all the value. So, and that's, you know, that's one example. I mean, creators, so to speak, or the creator economy, or whatever, like artists, musicians, like it's not like the economy, it's a small part of the economy. But I think that's, you know, I think that that model and different models will be replicated across broader parts of the economy.
You're right, it's a small part of the economy, but it's a huge part of what makes lives rich and enjoyable, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And I mean, that's what this is all about. So I think, like, you know, I'm not a crypto is going to own the world kind of guy. I think, you know, I mean, many parts of the world, you know, my wife's Mexican. Every time I go to Mexico, like parts of Mexico, you know, like the internet hasn't arrived yet. Like, I think everything will coexist, you know, big corporate, you know, Spotify will exist, crypto will exist, traditional finance will exist, traditional governments will exist wherever you go. But I think it's unbelievably exciting that you're getting it. You know, technology is enabling an exit or new pathways, new communities to be built, you know, new governance mechanisms, and people are experimenting, and they will recreate and make a lot of the same mistakes that have been created in the past. But I think, you know, through human history, every item from like the hammer to the axe to the wheel, whatever, has gone through all these iterative phases to go from where it started to where it ended up. And kind of spawned new tools along the way. And so I think we're going to the same thing with institutional governance frameworks, with financial systems and the like. And that's enormously exciting that we get to be a part of that.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I saw that phrase, I was reading something about like reinventing the wheel. Maybe it was a meme, you know, about like they found these like carts that were 6,000 years old. So you could see these old school ways of doing wheels. And I was like, yeah, reinventing the wheel. It had to be reinvented many times. Like, yeah. There's a long way from that to like a bicycle tire with spokes and like layers of rubber and tubing. And
I know a recent innovation on the wheel. I think this is shocking that in like, you know, in 2020s, this is what's happening. So I ride a road bike, and I'm going to like get the terminology. Like, I ride my bike. I'm not like a big bike head, you know, who kind of knows all the terminology. So your
judgment here. You can,
but your viewers are going to be like, he got that. This part all wrong or whatever. So I'm kind of caveating at the start, but I about a few years ago, this is within the last 5 years, this is hyper recent, they basically discovered that if you ride a slightly wider tire on your bike and at a lower pressure, you'll actually go faster and it's more efficient. And so that is like a zero cost innovation. It's meaningful. Like, it's not just like super marginal, like it's meaningful. And, you know, this is after, I don't know how many billions of dollars have gone into R&D over the last 40 years to improve road bikes. Like, they've changed dramatically, but they've only discovered this most trivial, you know, step up in performance over the last 5 years. And so, you know, someone should write that up in detail, like exactly what they found and how that works. But I find that like I'm still shocked, because I think that just shows the nature of progress. And you've probably got all these kind of low-hanging fruits lying around, and someone's tinkering it, and then or everyone gets herded down, you know, this kind of herd mentality path. You know, I mean, the story of the combustion engine versus the electric battery, you know, things could have gone very differently 120 years ago. It's total path dependence. And, you know, we're driving around with these like these combusting, like exploding things in our cars, which is kind of weird when you kind of had, you know, electricity for all that time. So, I mean, I think like the future, you know, is not kind of determined. And I think there are $100 bills lying around in terms of innovation and progress.
Yeah, what was the classic one? Yeah, it was like it took them ages to figure out to put wheels on luggage. Like, that's a relatively recent, that's like living memory. People just carry bags around.
That's a great example. Or, you know, I mean, I was reading about Mexicans, the Mexican societies pre-colonization, and they didn't have the wheel. you know, and they were like these people built cities. That,
we're talking about Aztec or Maya?
We're talking about Aztecs. As I understand, Aztecs is a bit of a misnomer. It's like a triple alliance of different kind of communities or empires. And it was all kind of, they're all like killing each other and conquering each other. It was all, you know, but they were hyper sophisticated. So the soldiers, the Spanish soldiers that arrived, and they had seen Rome, they had seen, the Ottomans, they had seen the best of what Europe had to offer, were shocked at the advanced technology of these cities on the water, and they thought it was unbelievable. So these were advanced societies that had built what they had built without the wheel, for example. And so it just shows kind of the what else, we're seeing one universe, but and in some respects we're seeing in terms of our current society, and we're seeing hyper development along some axes, but I'm sure that there are like axes upon which we're relatively underdeveloped, which are fairly low hanging, so to speak.
Yeah, and don't forget, I went to Mexico City a couple of times because I have a friend there. I went to the museum there and had this enormous slab that they did human sacrifices on, and you can just see this thing. It's the size of like two dinner tables, but like solid rock. You know, the whole thing was terrifying. I'll never forget that. Have you spent much time in Mexico?
To be honest, I don't know how many times I've been there, probably 10 times or something so far. And often it's like wrapped up in family stuff. So, but we have road tripped around a little bit. There's a book, Fire and Blood, which I'm kind of referring to now, which I just highly recommend. It's totally non-finance or investing related. It's just the kind of history of Mexico from the dawn of time till like the 90s. And so I think there should be more books written like that. But I mean, you know, with the whole sacrifice thing, I think it's interesting watching other societies ossify and become sclerotic, which is kind of what the Aztecs had become when the Spaniards rocked up. So kind of coupled with that kind of poor governance structure. For example, they have these fake wars where they, the real wars and kind of real animal, real kind of spirit of battle had ossified into these fake wars where they'd rock up and it was highly ceremonial and it would just exchange sacrifice victims basically for the purpose of appeasing their gods. And so they'd kind of got stuck in this local minimum basically in terms of like institutional or religious or social technology, if you want to frame it that way. And so it became kind of rife for disruption by the Spaniards, who came along with bringing disease, obviously, and cannons and the like, just basically with a very small number of men destroyed, an empire of millions. And so, I mean, I think those lessons are instructive. And I think, we're seeing that today, in technology and what can happen with a few focused people, looking at the right opportunity.
Mm. This Mexico is interesting, it's just that there's so many different elements to it. Surf cultures in one small bit, which I obviously spent a bit of time in, then you've got Mexico City, that crazy high altitude, and then you've got that drug war that was just so violent from the outside in a country where there's, 100 million plus people just living their lives.
It's always hard to know exactly what's going on. And I think, I get snippets of news from my wife. I don't follow super close, but she's like, have you seen what the president's done? And it like, the political culture and the political economy there is like, I'm so grateful for what we have in Australia. It's like pretty boring, basically. And whereas there, it's like total insanity running amok and corruption. And you never know how big the narco threat is and which states are effectively, under the government's control versus not in the government's control. One really interesting thing I noticed comparing Australia to Mexico, and I might write something up about this, but one of the original, I don't know what the opposite of an original sin in Australia is, but like one of the great features that were kind of bestowed in terms of governance and institutions in Australia was the distribution of land, and it was kind of widely distributed and it wasn't kind of controlled by a few families like Argentina across and like a lot of the a lot Latin America, and that basically created a more egalitarian society and the wealth was kind of more broadly distributed and here we are. Whereas in Mexico, fights over land and who's owning land, from the church to big landowners to has been one of the causes of revolutions and fighting for like 300 years, and it's kind of persisting today in terms of the industrial class and the like. And so you can kind of see these original sins at the formation, which are very hard to kind of unwind, subsequently, and or leads to like meaningful conflict and violence.
So is the argument that they were more diverse in terms of land ownership, so more conflict but less ossified?
In Mexico.
Mexico versus relative to other parts of South America.
Well, I mean, I think a lot of, you know, the church ended up owning a lot, and then rich landowners ended up owning a lot, and so a lot of the a lot of other power centers felt disenfranchised, basically, and so they kept fighting over, and rather than a new system being in place, it was like say goodbye to the old boss, say hello to the new boss kind of dynamic, where you just had new landowners coming in and kind of the conflicts kind of continuing in cycle. Whereas in Australia, I think one thing that the British endowed on a lot of their colonies, it was effectively systems of governance and institutions that persisted and were amenable to change and distributed wealth somewhat relative to other colonies, and you kind of see the impact that has on kind of wealth creation over time. This is kind of my layperson's view. I don't know how we kind of got stuck on this tangent, but it's one thing that I've been thinking about.
Yeah, and I love that stuff. I remember reading an essay on Argentina versus Australia 100 years ago. So same wealth, same kind of, what's the right word? Latitude, longitude?
Yeah.
I guess latitude. You know, both have immense natural resources. Different set of issues, like agrarian economies at the time, mining. And I think the conclusion was, there are a few, and again, it's probably like a layman simplification, but it seemed to ring true, because they then expanded that point to other countries. It was kind of in Argentina, though, these big land-holding families, which you're alluding to, which meant the height of cool was to be sitting in Buenos Aires and not work.
That's right.
And the English had that as well. And that like pervades the English society as well. So it's cool to be a lord and write a play in your spare time, do a little bit of art. It's like the upper class does science, in a lab full of technicians. The lower class did all the engineering stuff and all the Industrial Revolution, and as in some societies, like America, Australia, effectively, Canada, they're industrious, free working. Whereas there's other societies that don't have those as their core values. The core value is to be wealthy, to sit on your wealth, and to not get your hands too dirty, and to be in the capital and live a life of luxury. I thought that was quite interesting.
There's a great book called Albion Seed, which tracks the four different waves of migrants that came to the US from their places of origins in England, and the dramatically different cultures they had, from like the Virginians to the Protestants and to the people going to Appalachia from the Scottish Irish borderlands and so on, and it talks exactly about that, like what they prized relatively in terms of what was high status and low status, in terms of work ethic, in terms of how they lived, in terms of the language they used and the like. And so I think it cuts along those exact lines. We had these Virginian plant owners who, their purpose was to kill time, so to speak, and show you how great
American
that was.
South versus American North.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Versus, the Protestant ethic where, it's not about being showy, it's about working really hard. And so, I think that's super interesting. One book I read that covered, which I think is excellent and your viewers might be interested, was Why Australia Prospered. I think it's by Ian McLean from memory. And it does exactly what you described, it asks why has Australia prospered for 100 years, obviously. It compares to Argentina and other economies explicitly to try and answer that, which I thought was really interesting.
I guess the challenge then is to draw that lens. It's one thing to compare different countries 100 years ago and see outcomes. What if you turn that lens onto like our society today? What are we valuing? Which is that pushing us in the right or the wrong direction? That'd be an interesting question.
Well, I found, I annoy a lot of my friends and my colleagues when I talk about this exact question, because I think as I've been reading more and more kind of history, to be honest, I could kind of say that it's for investment reasons or whatever, but it's just because it's interesting and it's kind of fun. But it's kind of changed my perspective on that. And I think reading about dramatically different countries or periods of time gives you a better sense for the water you are swimming in today, and what are our current fashions, and what are our current kind of social derangements, and what is, you know, kind of broken today? Because you can kind of assume that, you know, there's probably an equal amount wrong today as there was in the past, and that we're kind of generally equally, you know, subject to herd mentality and subject to, you know, all our biases as in the past. So when I do point out things that just seem really weird today, and there's like heaps that's weird, and it'll probably get weirder.
What are some examples?
I'll give you one example, which I think's pretty weird, which I've kind of spoken a fair bit on my podcast about, but I find it really strange that, you know, today the polite public and very majoritarian discourse around child rearing is that we ought to increase childcare and get more people working. And I just, and explicitly, to be honest, to kind of allow more women and mothers to work. And I find the whole conversation super weird. You know, I think like in one respect, you know, it reminds me of the kibbutzim. So the kibbutzim were these socialist communes in Israel, and everyone kind of worked the land, and they all pooled their children together and basically said, we'll raise them anonymously, you know, it's all kind of fungible, so to speak. And like, there was no disaster story there, but it didn't really work for whatever reason. But, you know, I kind of find it strange that modern, hyper-modern capitalism and socialism converge on outsourcing your children to these centers. And I find it strange that we're making it a virtue of going out and working more and working longer and outsourcing child rearing versus, you know, parents having more family time and versus parents raising their children more. And it's very strange that, you know, we're saying, well, you know, we need to, childcare is super expensive, so we should subsidize it and parents should go out more, and, you know, in order to be able to afford more childcare. And the whole thing's like really strange and circular. We're not really asking the questions of, actually, maybe it's a good thing for parents to raise their children. And, you know, is it a better thing just to kind of increase workforce participation, you know, for the sake of it?
I've noticed that it does seem to be very anti-having, society does seem to be very anti-having kids when you're younger. You know, I'm like kind of, I guess, 33, no children. You have children, don't you?
Yeah, so I'm 33 as well. And I mean, I could like rant at you forever about this, but I've got like 3 kids under 5 now. And so I've got like, I mean, like, I think I had my first kid when I was 28, 29, which is, you know, old to, you know, normal for like, you know, basically any period of time before like 30 years ago or something. And today it's like, I'm by far the youngest guy when I go to childcare or school or whatever, interact with other parents. And I do find it strange, you know, I mean, you see this across the world. In Australia is like not the worst, but you're seeing across the world, you know, declining fertility rates and the like. And I do wonder what that says about our culture and our values, that we're turning into societies who don't want to replicate themselves, and that, you know, at the most fundamental level, don't value life and the creation of life. And so I know I might sound like a loony, like conservative, I kind of sound like a loony conservative to myself sometimes on the stuff, but I just find it very strange that we're like, okay, that's great, let's just like not have any more kids. And you know, I think as society, we should decide whether we're agnostic to the question, which I think, you know, Australians probably tend to be pretty agnostic to the question, or whether actually we think it's good and to center family and kids culturally. So what are your plans? Are you like, I mean, you're part of the guilty here. You're, and look, all my friends, I'm by far the youngest of all my friends, you know, with kids, and most of my close friends don't have kids, and they're, yeah, you know, and they're older. So
look, I do have a few friends that have now have kids. They're mostly kind of like 0, 1, 2, that kind of age. I think in my 20s, I think it's more like a self-centered thing, you're kind of focusing on yourself. And I feel like if you have kids, it kind of like forces you not to do that. And so I look back, like, why didn't, I think pretty much every decision I made in my 20s was to some degree self-centered, which sounds bad, but, you know, I thought it was like, move here because it'd be the best thing for my career, do this job, you know, set up this fund, you know, 5 years ago, focus on that. You're always thinking kind of about yourself. And I feel like looking back and when I was younger, I mean, I still obviously do that all the time, but a little bit more self-aware. In your 20s, you do that and you don't even realize. But I do think if if you did have kids, and I guess it can happen to anybody anytime, it probably would have got me out of my own head a bit sooner in that regard. That's the only comment. That's a pretty personal comment. I've never talked about that stuff on a podcast.
I'm glad I got to elicit that out of you. I mean, I found it super transformative personally, but it's always hard to know, like, there's a whole decision theory kind of, theories about this, but it's always hard to choose a different set of preferences for your future self, so to speak. So like, there's nothing inherently, you could argue there's nothing inherently better about the post-kids value system versus the pre-kids value system. And how do you kind of choose that? But I guess as a society, and maybe I'm just talking about book because I have kids, and so you should distrust what I'm saying, but as a society, you know, I have moved towards a view that, you know, I'd rather live in one that centered kids and family formation more. And there's a whole system around this. You know, I criticize, and I'm the first who's guilty, I kind of criticize the increased atomization that we're living in. You know, we kind of travel to different cities away from our parents, we don't live in the kind of notional village anymore. And I'm the most guilty. You know, I'm an immigrant to this country when I was very little, and I grew up in Adelaide, and I moved to the big smoke in Sydney for my finance. And I'm absolutely the kind of example one of this kind of the manifestation of this culture. But now, after I've had kids, I'm thinking, wow, you know, like, structurally, kids are way further away from their grandparents. And my wife as well, she's kind of this global person from Mexico. You know, I met her here, so now her family's in Mexico. And how does that actually work? And is that ultimately healthier for larger portions of society? You know, grandparents to be split from grandchildren and from kids. And I mean, these are really big issues, and I don't know how to even begin to kind of untangle them, but they seem to be like, I don't think we've done this before. I think it's a big experiment that we're kind of running.
In the last few decades, last 40, 50 years.
Yeah.
Actually, I thought a better way of saying than self-centered. So if, let's say you're young in your 20s, living by yourself, basically, which was very close to like my circumstance. Every decision of like where you spend every minute of every weekend is completely up to you. You know, you've got nothing. You don't even have like a parent's birthday to occasionally go to or anything. You're literally on your own. Foreign country, nothing. I think about my parents, they got married pretty young and had me pretty young. And just the driving on the weekend, like you just never even thought about it. It's just like, I live like in this side of Sydney and my game is 2 hours on the other side of Sydney. So we need to leave right now. Whereas your parent that has spent like 2 hours driving there, watch like some 8-year-olds run around a football field very poorly, in my case, and then drive like 2 hours back. I mean, comparing and contrast those, like that single foreign life versus that young family life is almost unimaginable.
I do feel like in the most basic way, and this is like not new or profound, but like kids just provide meaning, you know, like when I was living that life that you're describing, you know, like sometimes it did feel, you know, a little hollow for me personally. And that might be a reflection on me just not being interesting enough person or whatever. So it's always hard to kind of generalize this kind of stuff, but that was kind of my experience. And kids, certainly, as you say, that like you don't have any more questions because you're so busy. You know, your weekends are naturally filled up, your evenings and your days are naturally filled up. And I think, I found that personally, you know, healthy and nice, but, you know, each to their own, I guess.
Yeah, you might roll your eyes here, but I've found biggest sense of community, the most active communities I've seen, I think, in the last, other than obviously family-centered ones and cultural, religious-centered ones, have been these crypto communities.
Yeah.
I have an intern, very good. There's a group of uni students who until recently probably hadn't really done anything outside of, I'm aware of anyway, outside of uni school, that structured environment. Yeah, and they're doing an NFT project now, ZenApes, and they got something like, it's like 18,000 people in their Discord chatting in a community that they're leading. And you go on this thing and literally like the messages, like it's one of those like rolling screens, like there's that much activity. And they're connecting with, you know, head of gaming at like Blizzard and like all these like senior executives who kind of like, and I'm in the same boat. I'm like just fascinated by this community. Like I don't remember ever, I can't think of a single example of like a group of Oxford students getting together and forming a community like that. I'm sure there were examples. But in general, you know, people might put on a play together or, you know, form some kind of investment club with 30 people. and it would kind of fizzle a bit. I never saw this, like, tens of thousands of people, like these young people able to form these communities of tens of thousands of people. They were just so excited and obsessed. And like, you see these kids, they're red-eyed, they haven't slept, they've literally just been answering messages. It's really something, it really does feel something new, and that energy is pretty exciting to see.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, I've thought about it. I don't want to overfit to my biases, but you know, I have spoken in the past before about how, you know, are NFTs a substitution for kids in some ways? You know, like you know, there are 10,000 crypto punks.
Spend half a mil on a
well, they're expensive.
It probably does feel like, yeah, a trap.
But there are like 10,000 crypto punks, but this one is mine, and it's, you know, and it's generating, you know, and I like this one, and you know, and there is something, you know, in one sense you could think of it that way, and then as you say, I think kind of rise of digital communities is probably you know, filling a gap from the decline in real life communities, from our increased atomization, you know, the decline of like union membership and religion and all that kind of stuff. So I think that's like healthy. That's like a good thing that people are kind of yearn for this kind of community that you're describing. Or in another sense, you know, you could think about it as an extension or a manifestation of the extended adolescence. You know, people are like, you know, grown men are dusting all their cash on like trading cards again, you know, and maybe that's a negative signal. So I mean, who knows? It's probably all these things to some extent, and we'll find out.
Well, that's almost one of the universal scales, right? Like in evolution, things seem to go from being more, but I think about a dog, they're either more puppy-like or more wolf-like, and that's like a spectrum that can be selected for evolutionarily. And like, in, if you think about people, you know, people can be very violent. That's been slowly kind of receding from like our personalities. People like that don't do very well in modern society. People that are able to stay playful and communicative and really open to new things, you know, they're the people that have succeeded in modern society, using modern society being like probably, I guess, quite a long period of time now. I think that's interesting. So it just caught my eye that you know, the extension of adolescence, because in a way that's been happening in multiple, you know, aspects of our lives already. And it'll be interesting, you know, over the next 100 years, if you had to predict like what will we look like, we'll probably be childlike for longer, more playful, more open. Actually, it probably bodes well for the NFT space.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really interesting. And I do wonder, like, one perennial question I ask myself is, how much of these things can we kind of over extrapolate, and how much of these things are kind of cyclical? Like, I was reading Christopher Lash, who was writing in like the 70s, and he wrote a book, yeah, I think it was The Culture of Narcissism, which I just read. And you know, you could take the prologue, which summarized all their issues, and it would like apply equally today.
What kind of issues was he saying was?
Let me pull it up, because Let me see if I can read you directly, because I'm gonna mischaracterize it, and I think it's very apt. I'll read the start of the preface. So it says, hardly more than a quarter century after Henry Luce proclaimed the American century, American confidence has fallen to a low ebb. Those who recently dreamed of a world power now despair of governing the city of New York. Defeat in Vietnam, economic stagnation, and the impending exhaustion of natural resources have produced a mood of pessimism in higher circles, which spreads through the rest of society as people lose faith in their leaders. The same crisis of confidence grips other capitalist countries as well. In Europe, the growing strength of communist parties, the revival of fascist movements, and a wave of terrorism all testify in different ways to the weakness of established regimes and to the exhaustion of established tradition. Even Canada, you know, has this independence issue. So, I mean, I think it kind of goes on, but, you know, you can talk about the defeat of the US in Afghanistan, you know, our kind of concern over environmental degradation, the decline of faith in leaders and our elites. You know, you can kind of see, you know, when I look around the world, that's certainly the zeitgeist I kind of see in the US especially, but kind of, you know, across the Western world. You could almost just replace some of those country names with, you know, and it'd be highly apt. And so I don't know if things are cyclical or if everyone can kind of be pessimistic all the time and have a pessimistic frame. And so we should actually be optimistic because, you know, you could say that, you know, 50 years ago, and you could say that 30 years ago, you could say that 20 years ago, and actually, you know, we're kind of going okay, or whether things have kind of persisted in that same direction, have kind of gone worse. So I don't really know what the answer is, but I found it super interesting that you could take this assessment of culture and, you know, from 50 years ago, and it's like basically the same today. I don't know if that resonated with you or not.
But it does. I think the most interesting part is the fact that those two wars, so pretty serious parts of American society got involved in ultra-violence, you know, and that changes. I think that changes society. Think about the horrors of World War II. That was the people who fought in World War I. A lot of people fought in the same one. And if they didn't fight in World War I, they were kids and saw people rock up with faces blown off, no legs, you know, things like that. Like, it was a really radicalizing moment, was that ultra-violence of World War I that I think led to those excesses, or was at least partly. And you can obviously track the leaders, right? The leaders of the countries fought. You know, Churchill was in the trenches. Hitler obviously was in the trenches as well. You know, those men were surrounded by violence at very young ages. Not that I'm comparing Churchill and Hitler in any way. but you know, those societies, those people, like tens of millions of people fought in that first war and then committed the most outrageous atrocities that even vastly exceeded actually the horrors of World War I, you know, about 20 years later. And so I think when I look at the US, you know, and even you fly on the plane, and I'd like to thank everybody for their service. Not that there's anything unlaudable about that, but the fact that, you know, that's constantly in your mind, that people are going away, they're having their legs blown off, they're driving cars over bombs that are blowing up. If they survive, they probably were witness to, you know, massacres of innocent civilians by mistake, which happens again and again and again. You know, the entire establishment feels they have the right to just bomb, you know, and murder people without trial if they're in a foreign country. And the whole, like, millions of people are involved in those defense establishments. So I do think those wars that the Americans had, and actually obviously countries like Australia participated in to some degree, really must have had some pretty serious impact on society. I think that helped explain the radicalism around Trump, because, you know, a lot of his power bases was vets. And these are people that almost certainly every vet would know or heard of or been very close to, people that had died, who had committed these atrocities, who had, and again, I'm not drawing any moral lines. Like, if you're put in those environments, like, I'm not casting any judgment from this seat anyway of what the right thing to do in those situations is. And who knows where those, like, moral calculations land. But I did find it interesting that it was those veterans that had been in those violent situations where they feared for their own life, where they're up against people that were fearing them, often for very good reason, that you had such a crazy outcome. Yeah, so I think that does kind of resonate.
I mean, I'm like less uncomfortable casting judgment. Like, I think it was like totally appalling that the US basically fought this endless war and cost countless and totally agnostic to like Afghan lives and just bombed the shit out of like civilians.
That I agree with. And it's like, still a crime. It's still a crime.
It's a total crime. And like, if you read the details of how they were played by various, tribal lords, or they, like, it'd be farcical and funny if it weren't so savage, like what they were up to.
Yeah, on that point, just to clarify, I think what I was thinking, when you have, for example, there was that scandal in Australia where there was somebody who's clearly doesn't seem like a particularly nice person, who committed atrocities and then came here and caused a bit of mischief. It was in the courts. I feel like it's very hard to pass judgment on somebody like that. If you train somebody to kill, you put them in some violent situation and they do violent things, that I think is very hard to say what is right and wrong from the outside. But the fact that, you know, you've got the political establishment that is killing people with drones without trial and doing such stupid things, like just step back and all that money and lives and treasure, and you've ended up with these awful outcomes. So even if you just, like, you just know that those have been disastrous.
So I think, like, that's a good example of one of the kind of public derangements, you know? Like, I mean, you know, if you're sitting in, 2019 or like before Trump, say 2016, and you're like, hang on, guys, we're still in Afghanistan. Like, what the hell's going on? What are we trying to do there? And so, or you know, the border issue in the US, I'm not American, so maybe I shouldn't comment, but like, you know, like you know, he, again, you know, the fact that saying we should enforce our border, which we do very well in Australia, is like a politically charged comment. And so you have someone like Trump coming in and saying obvious truths like what the hell are we doing in Iraq and Afghanistan? And Trump's a bit of an idiot, but you know, he happened on these like massive truths that resonated with the public, like maybe we should have a border and maybe we should build a wall and maybe, you know, we should not be in Iraq and Afghanistan. And that just basically rode him to victory, because the political parties there are so sclerotic that they couldn't even kind of say those kinds of things. But I want to kind of go back to your comment. I'd push back against the experience of World War One veterans kind of causing or kind of making them more militaristic and kind of causing World War Two. In the US especially, I found it interesting that after World War One, there was such outrage at like corporate profiteering. This is their language, not my language, over World War One. The US basically like massively wound back its military industry and its military base. And so when it was kind of going into World War II, it kind of went from like almost a start of like zero. And so you've got the famous late start, but enormous ramp up of the US kind of US industry and participation in World War II. An excellent, excellent book that I loved on this is called Freedom's Forge by Arthur Herman, and basically talks about how US wound back its military because it was so like thought World War One was such a waste of like money and time basically for them, and they were annoyed they were dragged in, and then it kind of had to start again for World War Two. So I don't know if you can kind of link them from people being more structurally militaristic. And today I find it interesting, you know, I think we kind of as a society outsource our violence. Like there's no conscription or anything like that, obviously. And I think the last time there was Vietnam. And so now, like you're basically just sending off kind of professionalized army. People don't need to think about it too much. And so you can kind of fight this 20-year bullshit fake war on the other side of the world. And no one really like notices that much because, you know, it's felt strongly by some parts of society, but not kind of broadly distributed. But I think it was in World War II, I think, you know, you had 150 Harvard staff died. I think that was a stat I read the other day. So like, you know, the elite, so to speak, of society were very much vested in these wars, and they very much participated. Whereas now, no one at Harvard's kind of, you know, going to.
I think there are. I think if you go, I guess Joe Biden's son fought in the wars, didn't he? So I know what you're saying. It's sort of at a distance. It's at a much greater distance. It's not personal. Yeah. But I wonder if you went to a town in the center of America somewhere, in the south of America, there might be many people that you know who went to high school who went down the military path.
That's right. Yeah. But who in New York and how many in like, you know, Washington, D.C. or Silicon Valley have a kind of similar direct proximity to soldiers? But anyway, I forget how we kind of went down that rabbit hole, but that was fun.
Do you think there's much relevance in reading about these kinds of things, thinking about these things for the investment world?
Look, I think it's always easy to convince yourself, yes, because I like to do it. And so I'm like, oh yeah, this is really great for my whatever I'm doing professionally. So my answer is it's hard to know. I think, you know, one way that I invest is, you know, and this is not new, and many investors obviously think about it. So, but obviously think about the macro, and you think about, well, what really are the macro tailwinds? And macro tailwinds, you know, we live in interesting times, and, you know, China-US conflict, where Australia sits in all that, what's been the story of the last 100 years in terms of the rise of the US, what's Australia good and bad at, you know, what are the demographic challenges kind of being faced around the world? These kind of very big, multi-decade issues. I think, you know, definitely, you know, digitization generally and what that kind of looks like, these absolutely speak to investments, investment decisions. And I think, you know, not any single one piece of information might be the clincher, but I think forming a view of where the world's come from and what world you're living in and where the world's going, you know, I think that's absolutely relevant to investing, because I think you want to get behind the big macro tailwinds and avoid the big macro headwinds to the extent you can. Mm. So I find that way it's kind of useful. I mean, I guess aside from the whole, you know, Web3 is coming and digitization is hard for me to kind of point to kind of any specific. But for example, you know, I am generally bullish Australia. I think the world is decentralizing away from the US relative to the last 20 years. You know, I think we're creating, you know, we're punching above our weight in terms of the giants for creating the generational companies like Atlassian and Canva and, you know, maybe Afterpay and the like. And I think that has kind of, you know, the path of dependence we were talking about, that has kind of flow on effects in terms of talent creation and training and the like. You know, I was one of my, one of the companies that I've invested in, you know, they're doing unbelievably well, and they basically use Atlassian as their hiring ground for engineers, as one example, and they're based in Sydney. And so I think, you know, I don't know if Australia, for whatever kind of deterministic reasons, was destined to kind of create these giants or not, but we have, and I think it's going to have very meaningful flow on effect. So I don't know, I kind of take a very generalist view of knowledge. Like, I think knowledge is knowledge, and you don't need to kind of call yourself a public equities investor or a private markets investor, private equity investor, or however you want to frame it. I think I think every opportunity kind of has its own risk return kind of dynamics, and you're betting on like something, one thing or two things or whatever they are. And I think having a clearer view of the world in which we live generally, aside from just being very interesting, and I just like doing it, I think it does inform the way I think about those kind of decisions.
Mm.
What do you think?
Look, I think it helps. Anything that helps you step out of the day to day is generally helpful. The more longer term you can be, the better. The thing is, you can look at history and draw the wrong lessons. You know, for example, in the GFC, I vividly remember times where the 10-year return on equities was negative. And so that the conclusion that you take then with respect to long-term investing and now are very different. That was actually the second 50% bear market in less than a decade, because there was a 2001 as well. So that created a generation of investors who were very bearish. And then that proved precisely the wrong trade over the next 10 years. But again, zooming out, the fact that people are progressing, that technology is moving forward, that is really helpful. The fact that there's this universal human behavior is also kind of helpful. I'd say I probably learn more from good books about people than most investing books I've read.
Like what? Which books do you like in that category?
I'm a big fan of autobiographies. I think you get a good feel, a really good autobiography gives you a good feel of the trajectory that a person and often companies can take as well, and like the twists and turns in that.
I love audiobooks. Like I've like massively gotten into the last 5 years, and aside from history books, I reckon autobiographies are like really work in that format. And one I'm reading right now, which I started this morning, I'm like on my big cycles, is Let My People Go Surfing, which is the autobiography for the founders of Patagonia. And so it literally, you know, this bloke and the team basically making climbing hardware for themselves, because it just didn't really exist. And it kind of tracks, you know, from that, you know, and their ethos and what they were solving for themselves and selling to their friends. And you can really see the craftsmanship, and you can see, you know, in the background implicit in the book, you know, the kind of growth wave they're kind of riding in terms of the penetration, public consciousness of kind of activewear or specialized clothing, and really from the starting days. And so, you know, I'm not planning on investing in a necessarily in a hard, you know, a outdoor hardware business or a new kind of clothing company, eco-friendly clothing company, but kind of seeing how that, you know, real passion and creative instinct and, you know, particular kind of ethos manifest into an enormously successful brand and product and company. I mean, it's endlessly fascinating. All the anecdotes are wonderful, and I think you know that's kind of more obviously applicable to investing, I guess. But
you know, one book that had a huge impact on me, not just in invest, certainly in investing and directly in the way I look at companies, but also kind of more broadly. There's a book called Emperor of All Maladies. Have you come across that?
I don't know.
It's a history of cancer, as in like the disease cancer. That is the emperor of all maladies. And the stories in that, it's an example how you can learn. I find you can learn so much from a well-placed story, anecdote. Just the ones that come to mind, the way they used to do extremely radical breast surgery. And it was extraordinarily difficult to prove that that did more harm than good. It took decades. And women were disfiguring themselves. And it later came out that we know that by the time they're doing that radical surgery, generally they're all metastatic. It was already too late. So those disfigurements and those extremely painful surgeries were not doing any good. Another example is, the reason it's so direct is it really helps you think about data, particularly in medicine and biotech, was they had a drug for AIDS. And it also goes to the AIDS and things like that. And the drug was supposed to work, really good data. And they ran a trial, a really like kind of enough people, and it was like huge people over a number of years, was powered to show a result. And it showed the drug failed. But actually it turned out many years later, they figured out the drug worked. So what was happening is there was a nurse or a group of nurses, a patient would come in and every second person would get the drug. So they'd write it down, like it's like every odd number gets a placebo, the even number gets a drug. And so what happened is very sick people were coming in and the nurses, with the best of intentions, with the warmest hearts, were making sure that really sick people got given the drug. And so that's the double blind. That's the double bit of the blind. And it's just a really good example because that's obviously set that those acts of kindness set back the field by a number of years and caused all kinds of suffering and misfortune. And that's just what, they're just two examples of how the best possible intentions, like radical surgery, you know, more is better, you know, just cut it out. You know, do you want to do an extreme thing that might help or do you just want to do nothing? And then an entire field of the smartest people go, okay, we'll have to do the extreme thing. We have to do something. Or similarly, you know, I just want to help. You know, it must be good to give the sick people the drug. That then caused vastly more suffering. You know, there's just two examples and I draw that. So firstly, it teaches you a ton about double blind and the importance of data. And these are things you'll never know. There's no way in hell you can read an investor presentation, a scientific paper and see something like that. That kind of data. Oh, we told them to do the, you know, it just doesn't exist. There's no way you can read that. No amount of work will get you to that. And similarly, you think, and like, obviously I know you're already probably figuring this out, compared to like coronavirus, you know, and the political response to that and all kinds of other political responses we have to things. It's impact. Well, you know, we don't know. It's scary. Just do something. Do the most radical thing. Like shut the borders. Send the kids home. You know, people can't go to funerals. You can't get married. You know, just shut it all down. You know, forget the fact that then that was a huge, you know, as a mental harm and, you know, it's two years of our life now. You know, there's just this instinct inside us to just do something and just do the most radical thing when something really bad happens. And in one story, like just in a couple of brief stories and vignettes that I gave you, you can just see how that instinct to help and do the most from the most, again, like from the warmest possible place, from a place of love, of like, of wanting to do the best thing by the most people can lead to such disastrous outcomes. And there's so many examples of that. And so Emperor of All Maladies, good book, recommend.
Yeah, I'll have to check it out. I mean, I think it's interesting. That almost describes like all medicine before like 200 years ago or something, you know, like it was just, you know, you do not want to have a limb sawn off or like be bled or have leeches or whatever. And because, you know, people just didn't know and they're just trying new stuff. And there's a great story. I think it's in Robin Hanson's book, The Elephant in the Brain. I forget the exact thing, but you know, basically a king had some sort of malady and he took, you know, his cleverest advisors and they put together all these concoctions for him that just tasted awful and were terrible for him, but they had like maximum visible impact because the whole thing was to signal and to demonstrate how clever they are and how much they care and that these things have maximum impact. Because if they were just to prescribe sleeping or to just chill out a little bit and drink some water, that's not impressive and that's not a demonstration of their capability. And so actually The Elephant in the Brain's a great book on this entire subject where it kind of points out, you know, all these areas of life, from medicine to education to elsewhere, that basically we have these entire industries built around, you know, just signaling, kind of divorced from any underlying function, which yeah. And so it's super interesting, and you can definitely see
that's
that,
right. Yeah, so I was so upset with, I thought Gladys did a great job, but when she said, one week she said there's no evidence that whatever the measure was, sending kids home or playgrounds or something, and then the next week she did it. And it was like, you've literally demonstrated that you know that this doesn't help, and then you've gone and done it anyway. It was like, once people started, like, there was another one where they closed off the beaches, and I was like beside myself, firstly because, you know, you're locked at home, you can't go surfing, but secondly because, like, it's just a sign of irrationality. And once you see one of those signs, you just know you're in for like a world of pain. And that was 2 years ago, and it's exactly what happened.
I get into this murderous rage. Yeah, I get really. I mean, I won't reopen Pandora's box. My family had this quarantine thing, and I was quite vocal about how stupid a lot of these actions were. But what really made me angry, to be honest, you know, I was reading what was happening in Victoria, and, you know, I think there was like a family who had kind of contravened the rules, and they had done this at a gathering or whatever. And so the next day, you know, the premier announced that playgrounds were going to be shut from then on.
And I just thought, like a punishment or something.
It's like he's punishing people that can't go to playgrounds. Like, this is totally divorced from pandemic management. This is purely... is purely vindictive, right? And so I don't know, like, I want to, like, go riot in the streets. Like, that makes me want to burn things down. Like, who are you? Are you, like, a king? You know, like, you're just a bureaucrat.
You got a riot policeman punching you in the face. This is for your health and safety.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, the fascinating thing is
the Victorians support him. You know, he's winning votes. And part of it is, like, the thing that also annoyed me is I know a lot of very politically ambitious people. And these people, like, some of them want to be prime minister, whatever. I don't think they have any chance. Others of them literally have like 50-year plan. Like, they've mapped out each year of each decade almost. You know, they're really thinking long-term and strategically about how to do it, to the point where they'll say no to brilliant opportunities, you know, in their early 20s if they think it might affect them in their 50s. Mm. And I can see, like, whenever I see like politicians, I often see parts of these people in them. And I can see that they're just like creating a huge amount of political profit. It's a massively winning trade for them. You know, they're benefiting, you know, someone like Dan Andrews, gone from nobody knowing him to being like a national figure who can determine who gets to work and who doesn't. He can control who plays where, who's allowed to leave their home and who's not. You know, they've got this huge political power. It's almost like a currency, or it is like a currency. Because, you know, another one I used to get annoyed about was bicycle helmets. So there's very weak evidence over bicycle helmets. Actually, you've got three children.
Yeah.
Did you consider, there's also this idea that Australia has a secret two-child policy. And it's not just Australia, it's other countries where you force people to have particular child seats. And so what that ended up happening, it's actually very rare that, you know, a seatbelt will cause more harm than good to a child. There will be a handful of instances a year where that's the case. But then a lot of families stop at two now because they'll have to buy a new car. They just can't fit the... Do you have any thoughts on that? Did you consider that?
I've definitely got thoughts. I mean, we abide by the laws and we have the requisites. I've got three and they just fit in the back. But I think there's a study. I don't link on me, but you can kind of, I think Marginal Revolution, the blog, like Tyler Cowen posted the study a while back on that exact point, that basically car seat laws, have the effect of like reducing fertility or limiting it to the two, which is super interesting. I mean, I think like my thesis, and I haven't like looked into it, and I don't really know is a short answer, but like I suspect like there's this whole big car seat conspiracy, and I'm not really kidding. Like, I think like these car seats are like enormously expensive. You're about to have a kid, you know, like your kid's safety, you know, you're not going to go cheap on your kid's safety, right? Like it's like the perfect situation, like the wedding industry. You know, just because for a wedding, suddenly it's 10x the price, you know, because you want your day to be super special. I think it's the same thing with car seats. I suspect like something, you know, with either it not being there or with like 10x fewer features and costing, you know, a fraction of the price would have like the same effect. But, you know, no one, like you have asymmetric payoffs as a politician. Why would you be the politician who kind of goes, we should have fewer car seats? Like, it only ratchets up one way. And so it's similar with COVID, you know, like, I mean, the current premier seems to work in New South Wales, but like, it feels like you have asymmetric payoffs being the tougher guy and kind of just going harder at the risk. There's a good book, I think it's called The Myth of the Rational Voter by Brian Kaplan, who I also read his Against Education, and he's got a pro-fertility book as well, which I recommend. And I don't know, like, I've honestly, like, the last 2 years, you know, I'm increasingly just anti-democratic. Like, I'm actually not sure this is working for all those reasons that.
I think democracy is the only way out. Eventually, people will turn against it, as basically happened in New South Wales, and I guess they're rioting in the streets. And I thought one word that you said that I thought was most interesting was ratchet, and that's actually how I view all these things. You can only go in one direction, and it's like, well, why don't you just do this crazy measure? You know, it might help. You know, but you can't unwind that. You know, you'll need to get somebody to get up and waste political. And this would be one of these people that, this would be one of these highly ambitious people that has like a 30-year plan to be prime minister. And they're on, or 50-year plan, and they're on like year 25. And you're going to get that person to go up and say, actually, we should make child seats smaller, which might be less safe. You know, and then immediately there'll be advertisements of people arguing the opposite. It's a ratchet, one direction.
It's the same with any legislation. You know, we are like, if you read legislation from like, 50 and certainly from like 100 years ago, like, it's short and legible, and you and I can just kind of read it and we kind of get it. Today, you know, it's like a textbook of legislation. Like 0% of politicians have read it, and it gets passed and it never goes away. And then you kind of get a new, so you get like this enormous flourishing of like regulations, which no one knows how to abide by this stuff. This is Australia, this is especially bad in the US. And so you've got all these like libertarian types arguing for things like sunset clauses, which automatically kind of, you know, so the legislation ends, or you know, you can't introduce a new piece of legislation without replacing a former piece, because it's kind of all ratcheting in one direction, and it has the effect of you know, executive rule, because there's so many laws and no one knows how to kind of, no one can kind of encompass all the laws in one mind or one institution. It becomes arbitrary because you can't enforce them all, so you enforce them as you like. And so it adds to this whole scleroticism. Like, I at one point in the future, you know, in 100 years, as we kind of look back and look at Aztec scleroticism, and like 30% of their working days were devoted to like religious ceremony and these fake wars of like for sacrifices, in the same way we're going to look at today and go, like, they're introducing textbooks of legislation that just mounted up regulations that no one knew or read what they are, and only ratcheted up one way. It's another one of those derangements that that we're talking about.
Yeah, I guess it certainly leads to higher bureaucracy. And, you know, there's a lot of, like, you know, COVID offices, you know, all companies have hired people to manage their COVID policies. Every local government, every state government, they all have, there's a lot of people invested in this now. You know, it's not going to go away politically.
Yeah, well, I mean, I did feel gloomy, you know. This, I mean, we don't know how bad Omicron is or how you pronounce it. You know, it, as we said, it looks fairly low symptoms, but, you know, maybe it's serious, maybe it's not. If it is a serious thing, and if it is vaccine resistant, I mean, imagine living in this world now where every 12, 18 months, whatever it is, there's a new hyper dangerous variant and people can't travel.
You know what it is, dear Michelle, you know the key thing is, it's not even gonna be a variant. You know, there's crazy flus all the time, you know, swine flu. I remember like that went through the world and everybody got it. You know, it might even not even be coronavirus next time, it might be something else. But there's this precedent, there's scary new virus that you can lock people in their houses, cancel weddings, send kids home from school, shut playgrounds. And there's nothing you can do about it. You know, it's very depressing.
I mean, some of the governance crypto people, you know, talk about this, and like, we'll see where it goes. It's pretty nascent, but you know, can you effectively exit the current you know, institutional framework? Can you, you know, work together with you know, online networks and communities around the world that have a lot of money and coordinate to buy tracts of land somewhere that will be amenable to their own governments and set up communities that kind of exit this madness? Now, like, it sounds a bit radical, but, you know, it has precedence. You know, Singapore, Israel, you know, in the past, Australia was a frontier nation that kind of got built, you know, as a colony state, obviously, but then kind of, you know, transformed. So we're kind of, you know, living in a strange world where in the last 100 years, we haven't built a new city in Australia or meaningfully in the US, which is just really strange. You know, there's no law of God that said, thou shalt have 5 cities. You know, we have this enormous, beautiful coastline, infinite energy and food in this country, and we're just funneling everyone into like Sydney's western suburbs for some reason. So I'm actually optimistic that, you know, maybe Web3 or the kind of changes in the political zeitgeist will see more innovations around the types of communities and institutions we can build.
I think, you know, it's kind of like in business. Like, to set up a business, you need to have some moment of courage where you just go out and leap out and do it. And I feel like politics has the same kind of dynamic in the sense that political space opens up, and yet somebody has to have the courage to do it. And funnily enough, they only need to do it once often to then be, to like make a name. So the New South Wales current premier, he strikes me as somebody like that. I think he believes it as well. There's a bit of luck that, you know, the political space opens up where you already are, which is kind of seems to be what happened with Trump. But, you know, in Dominic, there's now enough people angry about these policies that allowed him to then take that space. And then to move on to your other point, it's people are now voting with their feet. Like, there's Melbourne, and then I can only talk to anecdote. But, you know, actually statistically, you know, the population of Victoria is declining. People this year are going to think very hard over where they want to live. And, you know, within the United States, Miami, Texas, you know, the places that are most free in that regard are going to attract more people, I think. And, you know, people around Australia, particularly if Sydney stays as the only major city with open borders internationally, people will slowly move here. And within Sydney, again, this is more anecdote than statistics, but I do know a lot of people are thinking very hard, you know, I should be going up in, you know, living in Byron Bay, living in Central Coast, going down to Wollongong, living on the South Coast. I think people will vote with their feet. So I think you probably don't need like a new crypto state, but with time, these policies will impact where people, what people do.
So I kind of agree. I mean, I thought a lot about this a couple of years ago when you had the Hong Kong protests ahead of the kind of Hong Kong annexation or whatever happened. And I thought, you know what, you've got millions of educated, wealthy, English-speaking folks who've come from a common law country. You know, we shared the same highest court until 1975, I think it was. You know, like, we are bonded in many ways. Why wouldn't we build a new Hong Kong in Australia? Like, it kind of sounds weird and absurd. No one obviously spoke about it in any level of seriousness, but I wrote this essay and I kind of shared it, and it kind of catalyzed me having a podcast in life, because it kind of occurred to me that no one's talking about these kinds of things, and we used to be a frontier nation that did that kind of stuff. And so I'm very pro-immigration. You know, I think it's understated that, you know, Australia has the highest immigrant intake of any advanced nation. You know, almost 30% of Australians were born overseas. And yet, you know, right now it's just being funneled to like higher house prices.
Australia's held Australianship. It's about 120 years old, right? So two of those years, the most recent 2 years, we have not let international arrivals in.
Yeah.
Isn't that crazy? I'm just putting it out there. You know, this is a big period of time.
I totally agree.
And how does that affect? Not letting international people leave and go see their families, which was cruelty. Like, there's literally no logical reason for that. Full stop, that was madness. It's irrational. What impact does that have on our status as a migrant nation going forward, you know?
Don't even get me started on that. Like, I wrote an article for USA Today on this. Like, I was, you know, I was born in Georgia, former Soviet Union. And, you know, I kind of grew up on stories of the Union. And so my family and my cousins and like emigrated in the Soviet waves. They were let out of the Soviet Union in the Jewish the Soviet waves, because you couldn't leave the Soviet Union. You know, these are closed political systems, because they break if people can exit. And here I am sitting in Sydney, you know, in Australia, in this country I admire deeply and I'm deeply grateful for, and I think it's probably, you know, the best country in the world. And suddenly, alone in the world, it suddenly bans exit. And something broke for me. Like, suddenly I look at the Australian polity differently. And I mean, again, this is one of those derangements that they were kind of talking about earlier. And I think Australians kind of take it in stride. I don't really know why, but, you know, I thought two things were like totally outrageous. One, banning exit. Like, I think it's just like unconscionable. And secondly, banning Australians from coming back in. You know, there was that period where, you know, if you're like in, if you'd been in India, you know, it's like a gazillion dollar fine for you to come back as an Australian citizen, you know, rather than, you know, you can't imagine Israel doing that. Israel did the opposite. It sent planes out, took its citizens back to its country, appropriate quarantine, which I think is appropriate, and appropriate precautions, which I think is totally appropriate. But what use is your Australian passport and citizenship and membership of this great country that we have here if Australia and Australians just tell you to fuck off, you know, at their whim? You know, it's just totally, it's sick in my view.
Just fear just took over. It was fear in the population that led to political, and then there was political fear in the politicians that they would not do the right thing and lose power. And
yeah,
it's very very disheartening to see.
I actually grew pessimistic, like in 2019, as I said, I kind of, you know, in the shouting into the void, like, no one's listening to me. I'm not like a figure of at all. But now I kind of suggested, why don't we have more of a frontier mentality? Why are we building new cities? You know, we can do this. We choose not to do this. And then as kind of COVID hit us and we, you know, retreated into the pettiest of mindsets, I kind of realized why. Like, I don't think there's political will, capability, institutional capability to deal with those kinds of questions. I think we're just kind of steady as she goes. And I hope that changes. And, I obviously hope this country can do great things. But I did downgrade my assessment of what we're capable of.
I'd have to agree. I think everybody's opinion on politics had to change. Like the way we thought about it in Australia, the way we thought about state politics, the power that was vested in them, the fact that the state could control basically every aspect of your life, whether you're allowed to work, whether you're allowed to leave, whether your kids could go to school, whether you could take them to a playground in the afternoon. Politics always seemed something like ambitious kids did. In England, actually, where I spent university, it was more real. Like that was like communism and like, you know, we beat the fact. It's like it was all these huge like global movements. In Australia, politics never seemed that relevant. It was just something, you know, annoying ambitious people did, and occasionally impacted your life. But that all changed the last 2 years. It was like literally every aspect of your life was all of a sudden governed by the state. That was pretty scary.
The best thing that I've consumed on politics recently was an interview with Dominic Cummings, who helped Boris with Brexit and his election recently. Andrew Sullivan's podcast, he interviewed Dominic Cummings. And I could not recommend this podcast more. Basically said, he walked through his thinking about, you know, Boris and leaving Boris and ultimately why Brexit and how that worked. But, you know, he basically said, you'll be surprised at just what absolute shambles and how total chaos it is behind the curtain of politics, and like no one's in charge and no one knows what's going on. And I think that's like generally true. You know, I do wonder whether there's a growing adverse selection problem with politics in Australia and overseas, where, you know, smart guys like you are going to finance and raising funds and, you know, or startups or tech or other places. And so, like, who here is really joining politics? Like, what kind of person do you have to be to persevere through like decrepit job requirements of like a state or federal politician? Like, there's got to be just raw, unabated ambition for power and like power hunger and like willing to sacrifice family and lifestyle and absolutely everything in the service of that. And like, I wonder, like obviously, how good can that possibly be?
Yeah, I can kind of see the ambition. Like, I can almost get in the head of somebody ambitious enough to do that. But you know, I was at a weird part. I graduated at a weird time where finance was like the end of finance being cool. Like the smart kids did comm law and then were desperate to get investment banking. You would be in the same generation.
Yeah, same thing.
It was investment banking or consulting. You know that like 2 or 3 years later, it would have been different. It would have been computer science, coding, development. And I think that would have been, most smart people would have been much, much happier going down that path and probably made a lot more money. And instead of, you know, launching funds and creating financial models and doing really good transactional stuff, which is heaps of fun, they might have been building products and going a different direction. The same kids, just a few years later. And then now you're kind of like 10, 15 years later beyond that. Now they all seem to be obsessed about crypto. So take from that. Maybe it's like what the smart, yeah. Yeah, it's an interesting one.
I totally agree. I mean, I did comm law and I went to investment banking and then private equity. So like I totally get that. And yeah.
No one seems to want to do that anymore. It's not what they're aspiring to. They're aspiring to launch cryptocurrency or actually, media is much more of a thing. So to be a YouTuber, to be a podcaster, going into media is much more realistic for anyone. You know, I imagine a lot of kids would know people who've been successful, you know, just with something like that.
Yeah. I mean, I wish I could, like, had real skills, so to speak. I mean, I can, you know, like in terms of building products and the like, I reckon if people are actually doing more of that, like, I mean, I think there's just a structural dearth. Like I was into some Sequoia investor and he was saying they're like, I'm going to bungle the number, but there's some ridiculously small number of actual devs in the world and like it's a structural undersupply.
Actually build things.
And to actually do that. And so I think that'd be, in terms of to actually realize your ambitions and do that, I reckon, I mean, to be honest, I love investing, but to be able to build things, I reckon that'd be pretty fun.
Also, I went through a period where I was like pretty critical of finance. I was actually working in finance at the time, but it was kind of like, you know, you're just trading with other people. But then I think as I get older, especially now I see companies being formed, I see them raise money, I see the difference it takes to like, and I see that how important it is that the right companies get the money. Like the most successful societies, whether it was like, and again, I'm not saying these sides were perfect, but, you know, Britain 200 or 300 to 100 years ago, or America, you know, in the more recent era, they had extremely well-developed financial systems. And Silicon Valley, what makes Silicon Valley? To me, it's the fact there are so many people willing to give kids millions of dollars to build something and see if it works. Like that activity, that willingness to speculate, that willing to, like, invest, that willing to take huge amounts of risk. To me, that makes Silicon Valley, it kind of makes America, and like societies often seem to succeed and fail as to whether they're willing to do that. Will you give a group of smart young people who are driven, will the old rich people like fund that happily and then lose money, write it off and do it again and again and again?
I think it's an interesting question.
You actually feel proud to be part of that in some tiny little way, to be honest.
Oh, I think we are living through like another industrial age, like real revolution. I think it's enormously exciting. I think there is an interesting question, you know, how do you replicate that special environment that Silicon Valley had, that, you know, that existed during the Renaissance and Paris a little bit later? And I think it goes back to, I don't know what the answer is at all, but I think part of it goes back to what you were saying before earlier around, you know, what's a high status activity? And, you know, in Silicon Valley, high status activity was not like making a gazillion bucks and driving Ferraris. It was being a freak who said no to a $1 billion acquisition. And you're trying to like, you know, that would like
build something.
Like, so, you know, like there was a unique set of social cues and status arrangements that really thrust people to do great things. And so, you know, I do not.
Funding matters, like in the Renaissance.
And funding people, matters, absolutely, yeah.
It became like the status thing was to have a top amazing artwork done. So the wealthy people there funded commissions for a whole generation of artists.
Well, funding matters. I mean, a lot of crypto comes back to just a funding model, you know, like it's slightly different to the status question, but like, can creators have a, you know, capture more of the value and increase the pie through going direct to their listeners. And so in one respect, it's all just a rearrangement, and it's all just kind of bullshit because the music's the same and the listeners are the same and it's all kind of in between. But but that business model and that tech just enables, dramatically different, flow of wealth and economics.
Status is a really good lens to use that. For example, what does it mean if you have a Bored Ape or a CryptoPunk? It means firstly that you're deadly serious about crypto, like you're immediately sending that signal. Either you're there right at the start, or you've invested a huge amount of money, and either way, you currently have a huge amount of money invested in a tiny little in a JPEG. Yeah. You're already signaling that, and that creates a lot of value. You look at these things, you're like, I kind of want one of these things. Like, forget having a Rolex, like a 50 grand or 30 grand watch, how much Rolexes are on your wrist. How about $500,000 ape that signals your seriousness about crypto? Like, that is today's society is far more appealing. You can kind of get it.
The status signals of younger generations are dramatically different to older ones. Like this morning, just randomly, I was reading about another gentleman's club in Melbourne or whatever. Are they going to admit women or not? And I just thought, like, irrespective of the arguments, I just thought, who gives a shit? Like, I can't imagine any of my mates wanting to join one. I don't know if you're a member of like the Australia Club or something, but like. But like I imagine, and I've got nothing against that.
Not that I want to rule it out in the future. Should anyone be?
Should anyone be listening? But just in the wrong circles. But
like, club group of men. I don't know. Maybe you better have a few girls there.
Irrespective of the gender thing, like I can't imagine for us it being a sign of status in 20 years that we go to lunch, in this club. You know what I mean? I reckon. Having a Bored Ape or like being a part of a particular DAO or something is like more likely to kind of convey that kind of status
and funny enough, let's say you're a developer, everything you do, everything you develop, every project you participate with, that's visible forever. And it's not just on the blockchain where you can see it there potentially, but also your production history, your GitHub. Those kinds of things, like that's valuable. You can't fake that.
Anything else we should chat about before we wrap up? I really enjoyed this conversation, by the way. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, mate, this has been great. Let's wrap up there. I thought that's pretty broad. It was great to come on. Thanks so much, Misha. Really appreciate it. And let's catch up again soon in person.
Awesome. It was a lot of fun. Look forward to coffee or a beer.
Sounds good. Enjoy the rest of your evening.
You too. Bye.